Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2021, and you're listening to episode 242, which is a conversation about Luca, the new Pixar film from Disney. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a recent seminary graduate. He is also a graduate of Moody Bible Institute and an author for the website Christ and Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Friendship and Fatherhood in Pixar's Luca. And as one of their benefits, our subscribers can read his article for free on our website, equip.org. If you would like to read this film review and are not already a subscriber, you can subscribe to the Christian Research Journal at equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, as I mentioned, this is going to be a spoiler-filled discussion about the new Pixar film, Disney film, called Luca. And so if you are wanting to see the movie first before we get into some of the discussion, then just come back to this episode later. But this film is close on the heels, actually, of the film Soul. So they're kind of on a rapid release schedule, it seems like to me. And it's very good for summer in terms of it takes place in Italy, off the coast, and there's this kind of fantasy element to it where you have these underwater sea monsters who can come out of the water and turn into humans. So they're kind of like shape-shifting to some extent. And it's a story that focuses on children. So it seems to me that, you know, Pixar movies, of course, are really focused to children, to that audience, to families, for family entertainment. And they're usually well received. I haven't, you know, Soul won an Academy Award. And so it seems that they're very popular. So have you watched a lot of these Pixar films going all the way back, I guess, to Toy Story?
Yeah, well, that's the big one, isn't it? I used to watch a lot of them when I was younger. And my family tells me that I was really into Toy Story as a kid. And I enjoyed movies like Monsters, Inc. or The Incredibles, or more recently, Inside Out. But I've missed some of the more recent offerings, like I haven't seen Soul. But Luca is the first Pixar film I've seen in a long time and kind of enjoyed it.
So as I mentioned, this was just released, Luca. So why don't you give us a little bit more than my just very bare bones explanation about what this film is generally about? What's really going on in the basic plot of this film?
Sure. So like so many of the Disney Pixar films, the movie is more or less a modern fairy tale or fable, right? One thing I've noticed that Pixar has done more recently with their films is to produce movies set in different regions of the world, taking inspiration from different cultures and folklore, and that makes for some really interesting stories. So Luca then takes its inspiration from the 20th century Italian Riviera, which contains places like Genoa or Imperia. And it's against that backdrop that we learn about this family of sea monsters, and that's the regional folklore angle, and their son Luca. And there is this great fear of the world above, the world of humans, but these sea monsters have this ability to actually come up onto land and assume the form of a human. So, of course, Luca becomes curious about the world of the humans. He eventually makes his way to the surface, becomes friends with this other sea monster kid who is living up there named Alberto, and they bond over a mutual love of Vespas, right? These Italian scooters that are so popular in Europe, and they more or less make a pact to get one of these scooters and use it to travel the world. And that's the classic Pixar charm, right? These childhood fantasies that the story is going to turn around and shatter, because that's what makes these movies so poignant. And that's pretty much what happens. Luca and Alberto meet a girl named Julia, and they enter this local triathlon with the intention of using the winnings to purchase a Vespa. And there's a lot of drama along the way. Luca decides he actually wants to go to school rather than to scour the world on a Vespa. And the boys ultimately part ways at the end, but everyone has more or less found their place. And that's the gist of the film.
It's interesting that you note that some of their films are starting to go to different countries, you know, for those cultural folklore. And I know that they did that. I didn't see that film in particular, but my husband and one of my sons did, and that's Coco with the whole Day of the Dead and things like that. So they are trying to, I assume that sometime soon they'll have some other films, you know, exploring Africa or Asia and some of the myths and fairy tales that come out of those cultures for sure. So I think that's a good thing to note that they are doing that. I think one of the biggest things that I was noting as I read about the film after I saw the film is that both some Christians in blog pieces, as well as a lot in mainstream media, have wanted to characterize this friendship between these two boys. They're probably between 9 and 11 years old, something like that, maybe on the cusp of like 12 years old, kind of tweenish, Luca and Alberto, that this is really a subversive film about LGBTQ relationships and those kinds of readings into the friendship that they have. And I think in particular, it's because I've seen some articles compare it to the 2017 coming of age LGBTQ story, Call Me By Your Name, which also takes place in Italy in a small town, and then also has at the ending, you know, a parting at the train station between the two protagonists, two men, a young student and a graduate student. So someone who's still a teenager and an adult having this coming of age kind of affair together, a homosexual affair. So did you get that vibe from this film as you watched their friendship unfold?
Yeah, I've seen some of these news articles that suggest the film is meant to be read in that context. And personally, when I was watching the film, I never once got the sense that the story invited that kind of reading. And what I mean is it's never once talked about openly in the film. And I would even say it's not even really hinted at. And when you see the media frenzy, I think, if anything, that is just clear evidence of how strange of a place we are in as a culture when it comes to storytelling. And I mean, we do this kind of stuff with the Bible story all the time, right? It's not just, you know, secular storytelling. We do this in churches as well. We go into a biblical story and we demand that it fit our present cultural context, or whatever discussion we're having at any given point in time. And we then warp that story to fit our narrative, and then we go on again. And when the story doesn't directly lend itself to our interpretation or our present cultural context, well, then we have to get really metaphorical, and we have to begin saying things like, well, the story suggests this. In other words, if you just turn your head and squint, you'll begin to see it. And personally, you know, I think that's a garbage way of interpreting stories. It teaches people to absolutely destroy any sort of meaning in a text or a film in order to plug in their own meaning. And you hear this stuff all the time, right? We'll say things like, well, it means whatever you want it to mean. And all that means is that you're going to find what you go looking for. I think the only sort of intentional metaphor the film draws is one that suggests that the sea monster characters is a metaphor for feeling different. And that's actually a direct quote from the director, Enrico Casarosa. And, you know, that's very broad. It's an intentionally broad statement. Everyone at some point has felt different. You know, that's a huge, widespread appeal. You know, I'm a pretty old school dispensationalist in a broader church that is quickly, you know, becoming not dispensationalist at all. I feel a lot of times like a fish out of water, or in this context, a sea monster out of water. I can plug myself into that narrative. So all that to say, I don't think that the film actively invites any specific kind of reading. If it did, it would be a very different kind of film with a very different kind of ending. When the heart of the film, according to the director, is this really complex and interesting kind of friendship between two boys who are very, very different. One is sheltered, has these sort of overbearing parents, and one who is much more of a troublemaker, whose parents are not in the picture at all. And it's interesting to me that in response to these questions about the texture of this friendship. Casarosa, the director, has said that the story is all about platonic friendship. In other words, a platonic friendship is one that is intimate without a trace of sexual overtones to it. And it's interesting to me that the media focuses on potential readings and not what the director says the film is about. It says something about our culture when the only way that we can read a friendship is through the lens of sexuality. That's probably very detrimental and discouraging of friendships altogether, or just intimacy altogether. We have lost any sort of nuance and sense of depth or texture in storytelling, and I think that translates to our relationships as well.
It's interesting because the director, Casarosa, specifically said that the relationship between Luca and Alberto is based on a childhood friendship he had with another kid. And he specifically is quoted as saying, well, they want to portray this time of life before you go through puberty, before there's, you know, boyfriends or girlfriends. And there's just, you know, he wanted to have more of this innocent friendship. But still, you know, in the media, they're saying, okay, that's what they're quote unquote saying. But being gay or being queer is just not only about romance, it's about feeling different. So I think we should read into that. And especially some of the quotes in the film where the grandma who has been going up unbeknownst to her own daughter, who's Luca's mom, up to the seaside town for probably decades, she's quoted as saying, oh, well, some people won't ever accept Luca, but some people will. And he's found the good ones, meaning he's found the characters in this that he teams up with in the triathlon who believe in him. And so despite the director, we're still being told by advocates of a queer reading to read it as queer.
Yeah, you see this, if you step just beyond the film, you can see this as a widespread thing in American culture and really just in literature studies in general. I know you said we've talked before and you have some background in English and things like that. And you see this stuff in different, you know, theories of reading literature all the time. And what disturbs me about it is this desire to move meaning out from under the people who make it. In other words, away from the author, right? In biblical studies and hermeneutics, we call this the difference between, you know, authorial intent, what the person who wrote the text or what the person who made the movie says it's about and communicates its meaning through what is written. And we move the meaning over to the reader or the viewer and say, well, you just kind of dream up whatever it means to you is what it means, even if that clashes with the vision of the person who made it. I don't know that that's a very helpful way of reading stories or watching movies, because it suddenly opens the door and says, well, you can sort of construe this to be whatever it's about. And, you know, I don't think Christian parents, for example, should, you know, run in fear from Luca because, oh my gosh, CNN has an article about this film that has a potential queer reading in it. I think you can sit down and watch the movie without getting that stuff out of it. And in fact, if you actually watch the film without trying to read into it, it actually says some fairly profound things, as I think the director intended it to do, about the texture and the nature of these kind of platonic friendships, which is something that, you know, interestingly enough, somebody like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and even Charles Williams, they would write a lot about the platonic nature of friendships, the inklings, so that it's kind of like a case in point of these really intimate friendships between men especially, that were never, ever sexual in nature. And it seems like today we're told that you can't have those kinds of friendships without them becoming a certain way. And I don't know that that's very helpful. You know, my closest friend, this is something, you know, we laugh about all the time. We are polar opposites, very much like these two characters in this film. And in a way, we sort of balance each other out really well. And we couldn't be more different. You know, this guy's married with kids. So you can't find sort of honest friendships anymore in this culture. And it shows you how cynical we are as a people that every time you come across one of these friendships, we suddenly hold a magnifying glass up to it and go, oh, there's got to be something fishy or something different going on here. And I don't know that that's helpful. It's actually kind of cynical and mean-spirited, I think.
I think that's a good word to note for Christian parents, because if, you know, you read your whatever news source that you read, you know, you might get the impression that this would be somehow teaching your children some kind of, you know, queer worldview about these two kids. But you're right. When we think of the Lord of the Rings, I think even if secular people think about the Lord of the Rings and the different friendships that are represented there, and they're all male characters, I've never seen, and I'm supposed that there are sexualized readings of Tolkien, but I think pretty much everybody across the spectrum, whether they're an atheist or someone who's religious, would say that the readings of particularly Lord of the Rings are very much about this strong bond and male friendship. Although I think sometimes people have tried to sexualize Gandalf for some reason.
Absolutely. That's a great example.
But I think that's mostly what people see when they see those particular works by Tolkien, correct?
Yeah, you're very right. Especially the relationship, at least with the Lord of the Rings, between Sam and Frodo is the big one. And you're absolutely right. It's a great example. One other thing I'll point out. So much of the film, Luca, is about acceptance, right? And this is not necessarily meaning you're buying hook, line, and sinker the worldview of those characters all at once, but no, just allowing someone to be comfortable in their own skin and grow in that. The irony is that when you suddenly rip out of context what the story is doing, and you start trying to force the story to say something it's not saying, it's actually kind of doing the opposite of the point of the story, right? It's sort of doing the opposite of what I think the director is trying to get across, which is that you're going to encounter people who are very different from you, who are not going to share your point of view on things. And that doesn't mean you have to agree with them, right? I think at the end of the day, you're never going to look at Luca and say, well, the boys just all sort of agreed at the end of the day on certain things. No, I mean, the poignant part of the story is that Alberto ends up selling the Vespa. He sort of gives up what he wants to do because he understands that Luca wants to go to school, and he ends up, you know, compromising on what he wants and gives up and, you know, sells the Vespa to buy the ticket to send him off. And that is a much more powerful kind of message that you're not going to be able to just track through the plot of the film and come away saying, oh, well, the film's saying, you know, go out and do what you want and take what you want. It's kind of the opposite of what the film is saying. The sacrifice made at the end is much more powerful and poignant and speaks more to the caliber of the friendship and the honesty there than anything else. So the irony, I think, of trying to make the film say certain things, especially in regard to what you might call a queer reading of the story, is that it turns around and destroys the film. It's sort of, you know, it's part of that turn your head and squint and you can see it. If you just ignore the ending and you kind of ignore a little bit about the beginning and just focus on certain scenes in the middle, well, then you can get around to this understanding. And I'm going, yeah, well, you can make any story say anything you want if you adopt that approach. So I don't think that holds water.
And I think even on face value of the film, you know, which is not a Christian film, there are certain things in there that Christians should be able to resonate with, especially in talking to their kids. In other words, you know, in the body of Christ, we're supposed to have unity, but yet there's so many different kinds of people. And you talk about where, you know, in a body, the eye is not the foot and so forth. And I think there's a way in which you can, you know, say, okay, well, what is some things that would point to some biblical truth and concepts that are in this, if you're going to try to talk to your kids about it, because I think that there is that also, we're going to get into it in a minute, because I'm going to ask you a little bit more about Alberto, but, you know, how do you reach out to someone, a kid who might be from a home that's, you know, not your traditional two-parent family like Luca is from, that Alberto has a sad backstory. So I think that there is, you know, something there for Christians to consider that would be very true to what the Bible teaches about certain things.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
You're listening to episode 242 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest is Cole Brigette. He has written an online exclusive film review
about Luca called Friendship and Fatherhood in Pixar's Luca, and our subscribers can read this article for free at our website, equip.org. I want to say a huge thank you to three of our listeners who took the time recently to give us some reviews on Apple Podcasts. If you have not already given us a starred review or a short written review at Apple Podcasts, we would be super grateful, because that's the way that people can find out more about the show and why people like listening to it. And it helps us be more seen by the internet bots who will suggest this podcast to other people who are looking for similar content. So thank you so much in May to Tim Spolar and Yabfets for writing us a review. And most recently, on June 17th, there's a review from Quinliz. So thank you so much to those three listeners for taking the time to do a review for us. And I would just like to encourage everyone else, it's summer, you might have a few more moments. Please do head on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a review. If all you have time is for is a starred review, we welcome that. But even better yet is a short written review of a sentence or two. Well, again, we'd love to be a partner with you. The best way to do that is keep us bringing you all this free content is to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, which you can easily do at equip.org. If you go to magazine, you can see the drop down there and you can subscribe to the magazine. Also at that drop down, there's a way to give us a tip if a full subscription is not in your budget this month. And you can do that by just going to Postmodern Realities at that magazine tab, and any one of the landing pages will take you to a link where you could give us a tip. But really, the biggest way you can help us is just do some of those free things for you. No money involved, just a little bit of your time, not only reviewing, but sharing this podcast on any of your social media accounts. So we're really grateful for all the ways in which listeners partner with us. Thank you.
I just mentioned a few moments ago that I wanted to ask you a little bit about Alberto's backstory. One friend, when I posted on Facebook that I was watching this film, said there should be a trigger warning. This is someone who's a Christian. There should be a trigger warning about it regarding, you know, abandonment by parents, because they have a couple of their own kids, but they've also adopted a kid who had some issues with being run away or, you know, those kinds of things, and abandonment by their natural parents. And so you come to find out in the film, and it's not till the end, because Alberto first tells Luca, it's like, well, where are your parents? Oh, my dad and I came here to this island and he lets me do whatever I want. In the very end of the film, you find out that Alberto's dad has just abandoned him. He just said, okay, kid, well, see you later. So that could be a kind of scary concept to some kids. So can you talk a little bit about the relationship between children and their parents? Because that's something that is addressed, since you mentioned earlier, Luca and his parents are trying to make sure, they're trying to overprotect him. They're trying to really make sure that they limit, don't go out, you know, anywhere beyond the little area where you're supposed to be shepherding these little fish. He's kind of like a little shepherd of some flock of fish, and tell us where you're going. And we want to make sure that you live a very sheltered life.
Yeah, you're right. This is something the film does address. And this is one of those things that can get lost in the noise, so to speak. So I'm glad you brought it up. There are these very interesting, you know, ideas of family that are played within the movie. And so you have Luca, like you said, whose parents are sort of overbearing, and it's very much in that relationship. And I think this is kind of funny. The dad is very tame and is the quiet one, right? And just sort of, you know, goes along with things. But his mom is very overbearing and sort of, you know, to use the expression, wears the pants in the relationship, which I think is kind of funny. But his mom doesn't want him to go. She's the one who hatches the plan that, you know, if this is how you're going to behave, then we're just going to send you to live with your uncle down in the deep, right? To keep you from going up to the surface. And it's a beautiful contrast, right? It's very intentionally done to contrast with Alberto's situation, which, as you pointed out, is he really has nobody. He's just kind of hanging out on this little island on the surface world by himself. And part of that mystique of this guy who just is able to live up there with these sort of carefree parents, part of that is what entices Luca to get to know the guy. And how do you have parents like that? But again, and this is one of the things that Pixar does so well, is they show whether or not we realize it, that the grass isn't always greener on the other side. That's a theme in so many of their movies, right? The kid gets this idea in his head or her head that things are going to be a certain way if they just had different parents or if they just had a different set of circumstances. So then they go out of their way to have those different set of circumstances and realize at the end of the day that, oh, wait, it's not quite what I thought it was going to be. And Alberto's situation is that, so this is kind of interesting. Maybe I missed this, but the story never actually tells us what happens to his father. The implication, based on what Alberto says, I think, is that his father just left. He just up and left. But there's the whole thing, the whole subplot about the people who are afraid of the sea monsters and they hunt the sea monsters. So I also thought, was his dad supposed to have been killed and he just doesn't know or something like that? I couldn't quite put that together. But regardless.
That's interesting because you think, would you introduce that kind of a plot line to a film with kids? Like, oh, right. He was counting the days. It shows him like, you know, kind of like stranded on it. It's that stranded on a deserted island, right? Like, you know, Robinson Crusoe, here he is and he's taking his chalk and he's a kid though. He doesn't realize, but he's too scared to go to the big city too. He's just staying there by himself when, you know, Luca washes up on shore and, you know, he teaches him to walk and those kinds of things. But you do wonder what, boy, because you've seen such a long time when it shows you all the marks on the wall. And what did happen to his dad? Because it seems far-fetched that his dad would just up and leave him. But that's how he tells Luca.
Yeah.
Well, my dad just said, I'm can be a big kid now, and he just left me.
Right. And that's something I thought was kind of interesting and actually a really complex way of doing it, is we are never overtly, openly told what happened to the father, right? He could have just left. Then again, he could have been killed. Again, the emphasis on the hunting of the sea monsters led me to think that the guy may have been killed and we just don't know it. What's interesting to me, though, is that you see it. The only information we're given is filtered through Alberto, which is, you know, he takes this, you know, my dad just left. And it's kind of one of the big emotional breaking point of the film where you see that he's actually very angry about it, which makes sense. And, you know, I guess if that's a trigger warning or something like that, but there is a very, very intense theme throughout the movie about this parental abandonment, which actually makes the ending all the more profound, right? I said earlier that everybody sort of finds their place. Julia, the girl, she has a dad, Massimo, who is, he kind of is initially starts off hunting these sea monsters, you know, sort of this fisherman type character. But it turns out at the end, after all is said and done, that he sort of kind of adopts Alberto in a sense. And so Alberto finds this surrogate father figure throughout the course of the story. And so his giving up the Vespa, right? And I think this is very interesting. Luca, who starts the story with these really overbearing parents, ends the story with his parents sort of relenting and letting him go, which, you know, I really resonate with because my mother was always one of those helicopter moms. And so, it's, you know, every decision I make is like, okay, I have to have like a whole script printed out of reasons why I should do this. Very much like Luca, right? Separating from his parents at the end. So Luca gives up his whole, let's run around the world on a Vespa to finally get away from his parents with their blessing. They let him go and he goes off to school. Well, the mirror image, the foil there is Alberto, who gives up his dreams of the Vespa to help Luca go. But in return, he more or less finds a father, a surrogate father, to be sure, but a father nonetheless. And it's really a profound sort of statement to make about family, about how those relationships are supposed to be textured. And again, it's one of those things that really gets lost in the noise when the film is turned into, well, it's just a queer movie about friendships. Not quite. It's a little more intelligent than that.
And I think you just mentioned Julia, and just to give some context to who she is, when they decide to go to the big, you know, city and leave the island and they swim across the bay and go to the, you know, city of humans, they encounter this girl who's being bullied named Julia, and she's trying to win this sort of triathlon that happens between children every summer or something like that. And she becomes friends to them, and they're kind of a lifeline to her. It's like the kids who are accepting her, who aren't bullying her. And she's there for the summer because her parents are divorced, it seems like, and staying with her dad, who is a one-armed, very burly one-armed man who's a fisherman. So at first he seems like this ominous bad character, but he ends up being, you know, like you said, very significant, especially to Alberto at the end. So I really do think it's about childhood friendships, because they both have a friendship with her and she's very excited. And in fact, Luca himself decides to, you know, sacrifice something to help her win the race, even when things seem, you know, like he's going to be caught by his parents who come on shore looking for him.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I'll point out, you know, for anyone who has seen the movie, notice that never once does throwing a girl into the mix become anything other than platonic, right? Which is just another arrow in the quiver of the argument that says, you know, this film is not about at all what a lot of the sort of mainstream media is suggesting it's about. There is a rift that comes between Luca and Alberto regarding Julia, but it's everything to do with school, right? He learns a lot of sort of funny stuff from Alberto, like the stars are actually fish, right? And then when he meets Julia, who's been in school, she sort of shows him the textbook and she's like, well, no, they're actually stars. And it becomes this rift between the characters that has nothing to do with, you know, sexuality or anything like that, and everything to do with what Julia represents, which is the possibility of a life beyond, you know, a sheltered childhood and actually going on and learning and experiencing things that you just can't experience under the sea, as it were. So all the characters play a very significant role. And I thought the movie gelled well, right? I thought all the themes and what the characters represented and how they played off each other, I thought it really, really worked. Really, really worked.
Now, you talked about the sacrifice that Alberto makes because they end up getting, I guess, his Vespa, and he ends up selling it. And, you know, it costs money to go to this school. And obviously, you know, sea monster parents can't afford to send Luke at his school. And it ends on that train platform where he kind of stays behind. He's not interested in school at all, but he realizes that Luca wants to learn all kinds of stuff. And so he stays behind with Julia's dad. And so what is the film? Is the film trying to say, well, you know, just find your own way. Education isn't for every kid or something like that? Because, you know, you see this stark contrast between, okay, here's a kid who wants to go to school and here's a kid who does not want to go to school.
Yeah, that's kind of a more interesting question. I don't know that was the overt intention of that ending sequence. However, I do think it's kind of an interesting question to explore, because the reason Alberto gives for staying, right? I think this is interesting. The reason he gives Luca for why he's going to stay is that Julia's dad needs some help. And sort of the way they bond earlier in the film with the father figure is that he's a fisherman, and it turns out they kind of know fishing, obviously, right? Because they're sea monsters. And so they sort of pass the time helping her dad with his business. The reason he gives Luca for staying behind at the end is, you know, her dad needs some help, so I'm going to stick around and help him. Which really, you know, the subtext, even use that language, the subtext there is, you know, that's the dad he's going to choose. But there is sort of that motif there of the kid who wants to go to school and get an education. And then you have Alberto, who's really not interested in it at all. But he does stick around to do what would, for all intents and purposes, be considered, you know, a trade. You know,
like fishing. A trade school.
Yeah,
like with this guy.
Exactly. And he sticks around and he does that. And I actually think there's something probably to that, something to think about. You know, I work with people in different capacities in ministry. And a lot of the guys I work with who are younger are guys who more or less never stood a chance when it comes to going to school. So a lot of them, you know, come out of prison, because it's part of what I do is I work with the prison ministry. A lot of these guys come out of prison, younger guys. And, you know, what they want to do is they want to go to school. And that's fine, because you also get a lot of them who come out and say, well, you know, school's not for me. And I think there's some truth to that. And working with these guys and seeing that people really are wired very differently, and there's truth to it. You know, school isn't for everybody. And I don't think there's any shame in that. If anything, you know, for somebody who actually has a couple of degrees, let me just say, I know very well that having a degree does not automatically equal a job. A lot of times experience counts for a lot more. So yeah, I think there is sort of an interesting little wrinkle there at the end that you can explore regarding school and trade. And yeah, I think it's a fair reading.
Now, for Christian parents, you know, one thing is a lot of Christians are very wary about Disney as a corporation and some of the worldviews that are expressed in their content. And, you know, Pixar films are marketed to kids and they're for families. And I talked about this last time, so just to let our listeners know, because it is still streaming on Disney Plus, if you are concerned about allowing your family to watch Soul, we have a podcast that we did on that and also an article that you can read at equip.org that will really talk about whether or not your, you know, kids or your family should even see Soul. Is it going to introduce them to something detrimental? What would you say to Christian parents about, you know, should they be wary of this film? Now, you've already debunked, I think, the whole sexualized notion of this friendship between Luca and Alberto. But in general, should, you know, Christians be wary of any kind of theme in this, that they shouldn't allow their kids to see it?
Sure. This is one of those questions where I sort of look at it and go, look, at the end of the day, you know, the decision rests with the parents. And they're going to have to make their own decisions. And, you know, for some of them, it's not going to be an issue. For others, it will be. And that's fine. You got to sort through that on your own. But if the question is, do I think that Christian parents should be wary of, you know, oh my gosh, my child saw Luca? No. At the end of the day, I'm going to say no, not at all. I think it's a really safe film that actually has some pretty interesting and profound things to say. Maybe what Christian parents should be wary of is a kid seeing the film and then the kid being told by someone else what the film is quote unquote actually about. That's what you can be wary of. And as far as, you know, being wary of Disney, because this is a joint venture, right? Disney and Pixar. As far as, you know, kind of worrying about, oh my gosh, Disney as a corporation and things like that. Look, at the end of the day, folks, it's a business, right? And Disney is a worldwide market. At the end of the day, they're never going to insert something overtly into one of their movies that is going to cause, you know, the ultra conservative censors in, you know, China, which is a huge film market, to wig out and not allow their film to be shown, because that's a huge amount of money they're missing. So I think on one level, the nature of the business is that they're, to use the expression, they're going to get in bed with whoever is going to help promote their film. And I think what they understand is that right now in this culture, there is a huge market to promote a film in a certain way. In other words, you know, you'd raise again the idea of the LGBT reading. Nobody at Disney is going to be like, "No, no, you can't read the film that way." They're going to say, "Yeah, sure, read the film that way if you want to," because that's a huge market, and they're going to appeal to that market, and it's going to make them money in the end, and that's really what, you know, businesses are concerned about. So that's a really detailed answer, you know, something for Christians to think through. Well, should we really be, you know, encouraging people to watch movies or to, you know, pay money to corporations that are thinking like that? Well, you can go down that road. And I certainly do, you know, have friends who do go down that road, and they say, you know, we don't give any money to Disney. We don't like the fact that this is the way they're going to do things, or we're not going to watch Pixar movies because we don't like the fact that they do things that way. But the flip side of that coin is, well, look, this is the culture you do live in. And if you go down the road of, well, I'm just never going to interact with anything that the culture puts out, the irony there is that if you don't educate your children, the world's going to do it for you. And if you want to be that sort of overbearing Christian parent, that's fine. That's your prerogative. But I would encourage you to then watch Luca yourself and see what happens to the kids whose parents are really overbearing and the choices they make in the movie, because that's very telling. No, I don't think Christian parents should be wary of the film. I do think the film is a great way to have conversation starters with your children about some heavy topics. For example, what happens if one of the parents is suddenly gone? What happens? You know, part of the drama of the movie begins when Luca feels the need to deceive his parents into what he's doing because he knows that they're going to disapprove of him going to the surface. That's the whole, if you remember at the beginning, he sort of creates this rock version of himself. He sort of builds this little mannequin to trick them into thinking that he's out doing what he's supposed to be doing, which is sort of like shepherding the fish, which is actually kind of funny that the fish sound like sheep. I laughed at that. But, you know, that's a great conversation starter. Look, should you deceive me if you don't like the way I'm doing things? No, you should probably sit down and talk to me about it. So, no, I don't think Christian parents have much to be wary about with Luca.
I think some listeners might be wondering, well, why would we even cover this kind of movie for Christian parents? And one reason is that apologetics really starts in the home.
There you go.
Because you're raising your child in a Christian home. And when they're old enough to kind of get some of these films, I mean, I know younger kids will watch them, but, you know, children start asking questions for second, third grade about spiritual things. And I think just from our conversation, I hope listeners can glean that we are saying this is a great conversation starter for apologetics and Christian truth, and then asking questions about some of these issues. Well, what about wanting to get away from their parents because they're overbearing? Like, what should have Luca done in these situations? And, you know, just it's so interesting to talk through these things. And so I think as we train our kids, and as a matter of fact, we have a podcast, an article that's called Apologetics is for Kindergartners Too. So you can always start really early. And that's why some of these conversations around these very popular movies, we really want to cover, because frankly, if your kid knows any kids at school, they probably seen Luca and they're going to say, Mom, can we see Luca?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, is the real apologetic value is that right there, because, you know, you're going to turn around and send your kid to school. And, you know, all it's going to take is for one of their friends to say, hey, have you seen that new movie on Disney Plus called Luca? And suddenly the conversation is gone. And, you know, if your kid comes home and says, hey, can we watch Luca? And the response is absolutely not, under no circumstances. The inadvertent reaction is probably the kid going to be like, okay, that's interesting. Why?
Or so, I want to go to my friend's house and see Luca.
There
on
you
Disney
go.
Plus.
Exactly. Exactly. Which in this culture, the way, you know, every kid has their nose in a phone, or they're at a friend's house, their friend has a phone, has the Disney Plus app on it or whatever, you know, it's probably going to come up in conversation somewhere. The best way to talk about these things is to be prepared to talk about them, especially for the Christian.
So one final thing for parents that I'm wondering about what you think is, you know, obviously Disney and Pixar, you talked about the fairy tales and kind of those myths, you know, that they do, and going all the way back, of course, to Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella and all those classic kind of fairy tales, of course, the Grimm brothers type of thing. They always have these really happily ever after fairy tale endings. And of course, the reality of the world that we live in is we live in a very broken world. But if, you know, people want to see the prince come for Cinderella, or, you know, Luca gets to go to school, or Dory finds her family, or whatever it is, do you think that's a bad thing to have a kind of a neat and tidy, happy ending at some of these stories when, you know, life isn't always neat and tidy? And so should Christians be wary of that? Parents, be wary that it's going to teach their kids, well, it'll always turn out in the end. You will always end up being happy.
Yeah, so this is a really good question. I will say that Pixar, for my money, manages to thread the needle, so to speak, very well, because you get the story of Luca, which does have those interesting wrinkles in it, right? In other words, Alberto's dad doesn't come back at the end. He doesn't show up at the end and just say, oh, you know, I was just away on vacation. No, the guy stays gone. But the happily ever after, in a sense, is, well, he finds a surrogate father. In the form of Julia's dad. For Luca, you know, he gets to go where he wants to go, but he does it with his parents' blessing. You know, well, the fact of the matter is that chances are that's not how life ultimately is going to play out, right? The truth is that Alberto's father is still gone. And in reality, Luca gets to go where he wants to go. You know, one of his parents is still probably going to sit around and talk about him and be like, ah, I can't believe my kid did that. Or, oh, why did he do that? You know, that's reality. And this is what one of my good friends, one of my former professors, calls the Disney-fied version of the Christian life. This idea that no matter what happens, it's all going to work out in the end, meaning on this side of eternity. I don't know that that is a very great thing to maybe instill in your children. It's certainly a good thing to hope for. And I do think the biblical story rides on hope. It really does. The Christian life rides on hope. But understanding that on this side of eternity, it doesn't always work out the way that we want it to. And I think Christians should not only be wary about that in the films that we watch, but I think we also have to be wary about that in church. Because you do see, especially in America, this idea of the Disney-fied version of the Christian life. You know, if you just follow Jesus and you behave well enough, it's all going to work out for you in the end because God owes that to you. And that's not the healthiest thing to teach people, especially our children. So I think, if anything, having those little wrinkles, like Alberto's father not coming back, that's something to talk about. Or understanding that, or talking with your children about, it's not always going to end this way. And there's a lot of people out there like Alberto who not so much as, you know, it's not so much their dad doesn't come back. They don't even find the surrogate. You know, one of my coworkers at the ministry I work with in prison, he comes into the mornings, and this guy's, you know, much older. He's in his 70s and he's one of the hardest working guys I know. But he comes in and he'll deal with, you know, all these clients we have who have just gotten out of prison. And he'll walk into my office and he'll shake his head and he'll say, "All my children." And that's sort of a joke we have in the office, but the profound truth behind that, and this is what this guy will say all the time, is look, so much of these guys that we get, their biggest problem is they never had a father. And that's really what we do with them. We sort of step in and become surrogates and teach them basic things like, this is a cell phone, here's how you use it. This is a debit card, here's how you use it. So I think that is something that Christians should, I don't want to say be wary of, but should be aware of and help their kids start to think through. Because they are going to meet people like that. And, you know, as much as we don't want to admit it, for a lot of us, that's how life is going to go. It's not going to be that fairy tale ending. It certainly wasn't for a lot of the great figures of the Bible. I often encourage my students in Bible studies to go through the Bible and count the number of people who end their life, faithful people, who end their life in a position better than where they began. They are few and far between, very few and far between. And that's something to think about.
That's for sure. And I mean, even the people who have ended their life better than when they started, for example, Job, there's a lot of brokenness in between.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's not that, hey, sentimental, leave it to Beaver kind of story at all.
Right. Something I had a professor once, in particular, the story of Job. I'll just throw this out there very quickly because I thought it was profound. I had this professor say, you know, what did Job not get back? And you sort of sit there and think about it for a second. And you're like, well, no, he got everything back, right? He got his house back. He got his livestock back. He got his land back. He got everything back. And he said, yeah, Job got 10 new kids. He got new kids. But the ones that he lost, he didn't get back. And the guy said, you know, as a father, I can guarantee you that he would have traded every bit of the stuff he got back to have another moment with those kids. And I thought, that's a very different and interesting reading of that, that would never really occur to somebody unless you sat there and thought about it for a second. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of brokenness, even in the story of Job, and there's a lot of irresolution. If you remember the story of Job, all he wants to know is why this is happening to him. And he doesn't actually get an answer to that question. So there's a lot of irresolution that is left in that story. And, you know, a lot of the Bible is sort of written that way.
Definitely true. And for the Christian, it's all history too. So we think about it, you know, you don't think, oh, well, the people in the Bible had so much better family lives than we did. I mean, most of the Old Testament patriarchs' families were quite messed up.
Oh, absolutely. It's sort of interesting that the character I always go back to for this, in this discussion, I do think it's interesting, is Joseph, because he is one of the few characters of the Bible who, when I say ends life in a better position than where he began, I'm talking by worldly standards, right? He definitely ends his life, he's basically like the vicar of Egypt, right? He ends his life in a much higher worldly position than where it began. And when his brothers come to him and the story is, you know, kind of reaches its climax, and they're sort of questioning how any of this could have happened, Joseph's response is the most telling thing. And he says, well, all of this happens because what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And that sort of becomes the resounding theme of the Bible, right? You go through the whole biblical story and all you meet are these characters who think they're doing something really good, and then they stumble over into, you know, outright evil. Look at David, right? The guy that we sort of love to say, be like David, be like David. No, don't be like David, right? He doesn't do the right thing. Not only is he an adulterer, he turns around and has, you know, Bathsheba's husband killed, doesn't do good things. But David comes around at the end to seeing the error of his ways. And while that is important, the idea is not go be like David. The idea is more like look to Jesus, like David did. And you have to be very careful as a Christian in how you approach these topics and think about these topics and especially communicate them to another person, because I absolutely do believe that sentimentality, or what we call the Disney-fied version of the Christian life, is probably the single biggest threat to the church in America today. There's a great theologian by the name of Stanley Hauerwas who talks a lot about this, and I think a lot of what he has to say is very, very valuable. Because if you're selling someone on a Christianity that says, well, you know what, it all works out for you on this side of eternity if you just follow Jesus, I don't know that that's what I would call genuine Christianity. I don't know if that's the right kind of faith to market, so to speak, right? To use that terrible language, because that's really what we've turned it into here in America. Is we turn faith and Christianity into a business, and we run churches like businesses. And I understand that we have to do that to a degree to help the church survive. But again, if you're selling people on a Christianity that doesn't have any sort of wrinkle to it or irresolution to it, I'm probably going to question, you know, your interpretation of the Bible.
I think we could keep going on this topic for sure. And it's something that Christian parents should talk to their kids about, because frankly, I think there is the temptation for us to have the same approach to our parenting as people who don't believe in God at all. And that is, I just want my kids to grow up and be happy.
Yep.
And that is the Disney-fied way. We never say, I want my kids to grow up like Jesus. And in 2 Corinthians 1, it tells us that when we identify with Christ, our life will be full of suffering. And God will comfort us and we'll be able to comfort other people. But I don't think we think, oh, when my kids grow up, I want them to be more like Christ, and therefore I'm expecting they'll have a lot of suffering. I think we think as parents that we want our kids, you know, we can fall into that trap, which is an idol, unless we are firmly in the word to make sure we're not thinking, well, I want my kids to have quote unquote the American dream.
Yep. You know,
they'll grow up and they'll go to good college and they'll get a good job and then they'll get married and they'll have kids and the cycle will continue. I mean, because that's not the goal of the Christian life. So we've got to be wary of some of those and talk through some of those. Those are very good things to talk through when you watch some of these Disney films. Is that what life is like? Every girl will have a Prince Charming come and you'll be married and live in a castle?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head by bringing in the idea of suffering. That's exactly where Stan Hauerwas goes in one of his discussions I listened to. One of the things he says that I think is very profound, and I haven't listened to this in a while, and I'm pretty certain it's Stan Hauerwas. So I don't want to, you know, stake my life on that, but I'm really certain this is he was the one who said this in this interview. He says Christian parents in America, right, have slipped into this idea that no one is going to have to suffer for what they believe. And what he says is, if Christianity contains all of these lofty assertions about reality and the way things actually are that the Bible seems to indicate it claims, someone's going to suffer for that. And if Christian parents teach their children that it's not going to be them, that it's never ever going to be them, then you tend to get a church that looks a lot like the church in America today. And I think he's very right about that.
And I think in Luca, just to kind of wrap up our Luca conversation, there are elements of suffering in there. In other words, what are the consequences of disobeying your parents? Or what is it like to meet a kid who doesn't have parents? Because frankly, you know, even if you're homeschooling your children, you live in a neighborhood where there are maybe single parents and they don't live with both of their parents, even though, you know, you might have a spouse and you're living, you know, as husband and wife with kids. That's not the norm anymore in America. And so I think there's a lot of things. What is it like to be like Julia and be bullied by people? How do you learn how to be a friend to other people who might be bullied? So I think there's ways in which you can point out in this film, hey, you know, suffering is real. It's not all neat and tidy.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That's something I think I said earlier, that Pixar movies, at least the ones I've seen, Toy Story and Luca, I shouldn't say all of them because I don't know, I haven't seen all of them, but at least Luca, they do this very well. They thread the needle really well. And it's not all clean and tidy. In a sense, it's a fairy tale ending, but it depends on how you define a fairy tale ending, right? If you're expecting Alberto's father to return, well, he doesn't. If you're expecting things to end a certain way for Luca, well, it doesn't. So that's something we have to think about as well. And I think you're absolutely right. There's room for that discussion in the context of this story.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have a couple of fun rapid fire questions for Cole. So Cole, if you go see a movie in the theater and get popcorn, is that plain or with butter?
Oh, butter. Yep.
And are there any summer films, whether it's kind of like those blockbuster action films or more serious drama, are you looking forward to seeing this summer?
That's a tough question, mainly because I don't even know what's coming out this summer. No, well, I'll say this. I know it's not coming out this summer, but it is coming out in the fall. No Time to Die, the new Bond film. I've been waiting for years for that one. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing that.
Yes, I am definitely looking forward to seeing the Bond film as well. And I think it's going to be the last hurrah for the current Bond that we have.
Yeah, Daniel Craig.
And we'll see. Yes, Daniel Craig is going to move on. They're going to introduce a new Bond. So no spoilers. I've been reading about that, but I'm interested to see how they're going to pull that one off. Well, thank you, Cole, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to episode 242 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett, who has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called Friendship and Fatherhood in Pixar's Luca. And our subscribers can read his review for free at our website, equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comment section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.